Hello, this is Brian, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the September 23rd issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump says he now believes Ukraine can win back all territory lost to Russia with NATO's help. President Donald Trump said Tuesday that Ukraine can win back all territory lost to Russia, a dramatic shift from the U.S. leader's call on Kiev to make concessions. Trump offered his position in a social media posting soon after meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. Trump, in part, wrote, "I think Ukraine, with the support of the European Union, is in a position to fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form. With time, patience, and the financial support of Europe, and in particular NATO, the original borders from where this war started is very much an option." Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met President Donald Trump on Tuesday at the United Nations headquarters in New York as he seeks additional U.S. help in defending his country from Russia's onslaught of missiles, drones, and bombs. The two presidents, who have had strained ties in previous sit-downs, greeted each other warmly on the sidelines of the annual UN General Assembly gathering of world leaders. "We have great respect for the fight that Ukraine is putting up," Trump told Zelensky, who replied that he had good news from the battlefield. "We will speak of how to finish the war and security guarantees," Zelensky said, thanking the U.S. leader for the meeting and for his personal efforts to stop this war. As the fighting rages on, Trump said the biggest progress toward ending the conflict is that the Russian economy is terrible right now. Zelensky said Ukraine agreed with Trump's call for European nations to further halt imports of Russian oil and natural gas. Trump says the war was supposed to be a quick little skirmish. In his speech to the General Assembly earlier Tuesday, Trump said the war in Ukraine was making Russia look bad because it was supposed to be a quick little skirmish. It shows you what leadership is, what bad leadership can do to a country," he said. "The only question now is how many lives will be needlessly lost on both sides." With his troops under strain on the front line after more than 3 years of fighting Russia's bigger invading army, Zelensky was meeting world leaders in New York and was due to speak at a special UN Security Council session on Ukraine. Peace efforts set in motion by Trump since he returned to office in January appear to have stalled. Trump's Alaska summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin and a White House meeting with Zelensky and key European leaders took place more than a month ago, but the war has continued unabated. Following those meetings, Trump announced that he was arranging for direct talks between Putin and Zelensky, but Putin hasn't shown any interest in meeting with Zelensky, and Moscow has only intensified its bombardment of Ukraine. Push for sanctions and cutting off Russian oil. European leaders, as well as American lawmakers, including some Republican allies of Trump, have urged the president to dial up stronger sanctions on Russia. Trump, meanwhile, has pressed Europe to stop buying Russian oil, the engine feeding Putin's war machine. "Trump said a very strong round of powerful tariffs would stop the bloodshed, I believe, very quickly." He repeated his calls for Europe to step it up and stop buying Russian oil. Before meeting with Zelensky, Trump held talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who said Europe would be imposing more sanction and tariff on Russia and that the bloc would be further reducing its imports of Russian energy. European leaders have supported Zelensky's diplomatic efforts, with some alarmed by the possibility that the war could spread beyond Ukraine as they are facing what they have called Russian provocations. NATO allies will hold formal consultations at Estonia's request on Tuesday, after the Baltic country said that three Russian fighter jets entered its airspace last week without authorization. Trump said he would back NATO countries that choose to shoot down intruding Russian planes, but said direct U.S. involvement would depend on the circumstances. new strikes in Ukraine as the toll of war grows. Meanwhile, the full-scale war, which began on February 24, 2022, continues to take a heavy toll on Ukrainian civilians. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights said this month that Ukrainian civilian casualties increased by 40% in the first 8 months of this year, compared with 2024, as Russia escalated its long-range missile and localized drone strikes. Also, a UN Human Rights Office report released Tuesday described the dire situation of thousands of civilians detained by Russia in areas of Ukraine it has captured. Russian authorities have subjected Ukrainian civilian detainees in occupied territory to torture and ill treatment, including sexual violence in a widespread and systematic manner, the report said. Russian aircraft dropped 5 glide bombs on the southern Ukrainian city of Zaporizhzhia overnight, killing a man, regional head Ivan Fedorov said Tuesday. In the Odessa region of southern Ukraine, Russian ballistic missiles struck the town center of Tartar Bunari, killing a woman, regional head Oleh Kuiper said. Overall, Russian forces launched 3 Iskander ballistic missiles and 115 strike and decoy drones at Ukraine overnight, the Ukrainian Air Force said. It said 103 drones were intercepted or jammed, but 12 drones and 3 missiles reached their targets at 6 locations. Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin said more than 40 Ukrainian drones flying toward the Russian capital were shot down between Monday evening and midday Tuesday. Flights were temporarily halted overnight in and out of Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport, causing delays and cancellations because of the attack. The Russian Defense Ministry reported Tuesday that it intercepted 69 Ukrainian drones over a number of Russian regions and the annexed Crimean Peninsula. The Jimmy Kimmel saga is a warning to all media: fight Trump or forfeit free speech. The dumbest suspension in TV history is over. On Monday, ABC announced the return of Jimmy Kimmel Live. The news broke around the same time noted medical expert Donald Trump was holding a press conference on autism. Dr. Trump, flanked by more conspiracy theorists than at a Bigfoot conference, claimed the illness was caused by Tylenol or vaccines. Could it be Wi-Fi? Labubus. At one point, Dr. Trump blanked on rubella. His brain wanted to say Nutella. There is no shortage of material awaiting Mr. Kimmel on Tuesday night, but corporate behemoths, such as Disney, are running out of time to absorb this existential threat matrix. Waving a white flag whenever Trump attacks will only hasten more attacks. A grizzly doesn't just nibble on your toes. ABC figured the Mad King would leave them alone when they agreed to settle a winnable defamation lawsuit last year and pay $15 million. They were wrong. CBS figured the Mad King would leave them alone after they settled a meritless lawsuit and ponied up $16 million. They were wrong. The Mad King is even suing friendly media barons such as Rupert Murdoch. Trump is a maligned narcissist with tangerine skin as thin as graphene. All criticism, however accurate, is met with boo-hoos and blunt force trauma. He hates The View so much, he is threatening to revoke the citizenship of Rosie O'Donnell, and she left the Gabfest a decade ago. Retribution is Trump's oxygen. He is probably demanding all scientists left in his banana republic resurrect John McCain just so he can revoke the Purple Heart. So I will not give Disney CEO Bob Iger too much credit for doing the right thing by reversing the dumbest suspension in TV history. Consumer blowback was probably a bigger factor than courage. Sending Kimmel to cathode purgatory triggered boycotts. People were canceling their Disney Plus subscriptions faster than when they walked out of the Snow White remake. actors on Disney projects condemned the disciplinary action. Dozens of celebs, including Ben Stiller, Martin Short, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Selena Gomez, Jennifer Aniston, became bold-faced signatories to an open letter supporting free speech. For the life of me, I still don't get why Kimmel's monologue landed like a thermonuclear bomb in Trumpville. But the important thing, ABC is finally drawing a line, taking a stand, and adopting a defiant posture, even if this high road is really about the bottom line. John Oliver put it best on Sunday. There are only four appropriate words in response to the intimidation demands of a bully. F you, make me. The Jimmy Kimmel saga is a warning to all media outlets. You either fight the Mad King or forfeit free speech. This is binary. It is a zero-sum game. Cave in and the Mad King will keep caving in your head. The New York Times didn't flinch when Trump filed a preposterous $15 billion lawsuit last week. Then a federal court quickly tossed the suit last week like it was an arugula salad. As Judge Stephen Merriday wrote, a complaint is not a megaphone for public relations or a podium for a passionate oration at a political rally or the functional equivalent of the Hyde Park Speaker's Corner. Every CEO should tack those words on the wall, followed by Oliver's bon mot. There is a reason autocrats start by going after the media and court jesters who lampoon their absurdities. There is no Chinese Stephen Colbert cracking wise about communism on Beijing airwaves. There are no job openings for anti-government cartoonists in Turkey. An edgy stand-up set can get you beheaded in Iran. Upon taking power, Vladimir Putin was enraged by a puppet show that mocked him as a soulless and faceless homunculus. He forced the network to sell to an oligarch pal who promptly canceled Kukli. 2 decades later, it's easier to find an orange tree in Moscow than political satire. This is Trump's wet dream. He longs for a late-night landscape in which every host is a Greg Gutfeld clone or some other MAGA dope who is all blind praise and no funny bone. But if leaders across civil society would just shout those four words in lockstep, F you, make me, President Taco would cave and move on to something else, like blaming chlamydia on Advil. I hope Jimmy Kimmel comes out swinging on Tuesday night, dukes up, tongue as sharp as a samurai sword, and I hope CEOs stop cowering and start fighting back against this wildly unhinged and unconstitutional Trump 2.0 while they still can. You can't claim to cherish the First Amendment if all you really care about is a second helipad on the super yacht. Dr. Trump does not care about his stethoscope. It's the remote control that animates him. And all this is so much bigger than late-night comedy. American democracy is teetering toward the abyss. Fight now or watch it vanish. Everything's frozen for you. Stop on the street by New York City police. Francis Macron calls Trump. French President Emmanuel Macron likes to say that he can get President Donald Trump on the phone anytime he wants. In New York for the UN General Assembly, he proved it. Blocked on Monday night by police officers when he sought to cross a New York street, they told the French president the road was closed to let a VIP motorcade pass. Macron fished out his phone and dialed his US counterpart. "How are you?" Macron said. "Guess what? I'm waiting in the street because everything is frozen for you." French media that filmed the scene said Trump was in fact on the other end of the line, which a French official confirmed to the Associated Press. Macron explained to officers that he was trying to make his way on foot to France's diplomatic mission in New York after he delivered a speech at the United Nations in which he announced that France was formally recognizing Palestinian statehood. "I have 10 people with me," Macron said. trying to negotiate passage across the street. "I'm sorry, President. I'm really sorry. It's just that everything's frozen right now," one of the police officers told Macron. But since he had Trump's ear, Macron used the opportunity to keep chatting. "I would love this weekend to have a short discussion with Qatar and you on the situation in Gaza," he said. French media said Macron was able to continue his walk a few minutes later when the street reopened. France recognized Palestinian statehood on Monday at the start of a high-profile meeting at the United Nations, aimed at galvanizing support for a two-state solution to the Mideast conflict. We're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Bobby Kane, a member of the Clinton 12 who helped integrate Tennessee high schools in 1956, has died. Bobby Kane, who helped integrate one of the first high schools in the South in 1956 as one of the so-called Clinton 12, died Monday in Nashville at the age of 85, according to his nephew, J. Kelvin Kane. Bobby Kane was a senior when he entered the formerly all-white Clinton High School in Tennessee on a court order. He had previously attended a black high school about 20 miles away in Knoxville, and was not happy about leaving his friends to spend his senior year at a new school in a hostile environment. He had no interest in doing it because, you know, he'd gotten to rise up through the ranks at Austin High School as the senior and was finally big fish in the pond, and to have to go to this all-white high school, it was tough, said Adam Velk, executive director of the Green McAdoo Cultural Center, which promotes the legacy of the Clinton 12. Velk added that the 16-year-old had to do it with the entire world watching him. This was a couple of years after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown v. Board of Education that separating public school children on the basis of race was unconstitutional, and a year before Little Rock Central High School was desegregated by force. Unlike the Little Rock Nine, the Clinton 12 students were not handpicked and trained for the job of desegregation. They just happened to live within the Anderson County School District at the time, Velk said. Although the court ordered desegregation in Clinton was accepted by state and local authorities, many members of the local white community were against it. They were soon joined by Ku Klux Klan members and other segregationists from outside the community in a series of protests that led to the National Guard being called in to restore order. Kane managed to stick out the year, becoming the first black student in Tennessee to graduate from an integrated state-run school. What should have been a triumphant moment was marred by violence. After receiving his diploma, Kane was jumped and beaten up by a group of white students. In the end, only one other member of the Clinton 12 made it to graduation. Gail Ann Epps graduated the following year, according to the Tennessee State Museum. Kane had a lot of anger around his experience at the school and didn't talk about it for many years. He didn't want to remember it, his nephew said. He received a scholarship to attend Tennessee State University in Nashville, where he met his wife. After graduation, he worked for the Tennessee Department of Human Services and was a member of the U.S. Army Reserve. He never joined in the larger civil rights demonstrations, joking to the Tennessee Magazine in a 2017 interview that it was because you had to agree to be nonviolent. Kane told the magazine that he had no white friends at Clinton High School. "You have to realize that if any white students had gone out of their way to be nice to us, they would have been jumped on," he said. He also had to stop playing sports because the coaches at Clinton told me that none of the other high schools would play against us if I was on the field at the game. Velk calls Kane a reluctant hero. "This is a normal, everyday human being who found themselves in extraordinary circumstances and acted above those circumstances," Velk said. "This is a person who dealt with this tremendous difficulty and rose to the occasion." Kane is survived by a daughter, Yvette Kane Frank, and grandson, Tobias Kane Frank. Man who represented himself is found guilty of trying to assassinate Trump at Florida Golf Course. The man who attempted to assassinate Donald Trump at a Florida golf course last year tried to stab himself in the neck with a pen shortly after being found guilty of all counts on Tuesday. Officers quickly swarmed him and dragged him out of the courtroom. The jury of 5 men and 7 women found Ryan Ruth guilty on all counts that he was facing after about 2 hours of deliberation. The jurors were on their way out of the courtroom after the verdict was announced when Ruth grabbed a pen off a desk and tried to stab himself in the neck. As marshals were dragging him from the courtroom, Ruth's daughter, Sarah Roth, began screaming, "Dad, I love you. Don't do anything. I'll get you out. He didn't hurt anybody." She continued screaming as her father was taken from the courtroom, saying the case against him was rigged. She went outside the courthouse, where she and her brother, Adam Ruth, waited by a guard gate for their father to be driven away. Back inside the courtroom, Roth was brought back before the judge. He was no longer wearing a jacket and tie and was shackled. There were no signs of blood on his shirt. The judge announced Roth will be sentenced on December 18th at 9:30 a.m. He faces life in prison. The standby defense attorneys for Ruth did not have a comment following the verdict. Ruth had been charged with attempting to assassinate a major presidential candidate, possessing a firearm, in furtherance of a crime of violence, assaulting a federal officer, possessing a firearm and ammunition as a convicted felon, and possessing a firearm with an obliterated serial number. He had pleaded not guilty to the charges and defended himself in court. Following the verdict, Trump told reporters in New York that the case was really well handled. "It's very important. You can't let things like that happen. Nothing to do with me, but a president or even a person. You can't allow that to happen," Trump said. "And so justice was served, but I very much appreciate the judge and jury and everybody on that." Prosecutors said Ralph spent weeks plotting to kill Trump before aiming a rifle through shrubbery at the Republican played golf on September 15, 2024, at his West Palm Beach Country Club. Ralph told jurors in his closing argument that he didn't intend to kill anyone that day. "It's hard for me to believe that a crime occurred if the trigger was never pulled," Ralph said. He pointed out that he could see Trump as he was on the path toward the 6th hole green at the golf course, and noted that he also could have shot a Secret Service agent who confronted him if he had intended to harm anyone. Roth, 59, exercised his constitutional right not to testify in his own defense. He rested his case Monday morning after questioning just 3 witnesses, a firearms expert, 2 character witnesses, for a total of about 3 hours. In contrast, prosecutors spent 7 days questioning 38 witnesses. Attorney General Pam Bondi said in a post on X that the guilty verdict illustrates the Department of Justice's commitment to punishing those who engage in political violence. "This attempted assassination was not only an attack on our president, but an affront to our very nation," Bondi said. "This verdict sends a clear message. An attempt to assassinate a presidential candidate is an attack on our republic and on the rights of every citizen," Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche said in a statement. "The Department of Justice will relentlessly pursue those who try to silence political voices, and no enemy, foreign or domestic, will ever silence the will of the American people." U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon signed off on Roth's request to represent himself following 2 hearings in July. The U.S. Supreme Court has held that criminal defendants have a right to represent themselves in court proceedings, as long as they can show a judge they are competent to waive their right to be defended by an attorney. Ralph's former defense attorneys have served as standby counsel since he took over his own defense and have been present during trial the past 2 weeks. Recounting what happened at the golf course, a Secret Service agent testified earlier in the trial that he spotted Ralph before Trump came into view. Ralph aimed his rifle at the agent, who opened fire, causing Ralph to drop his weapon and flee without firing a shot, the agent said. Law enforcement obtained help from a witness who testified that he saw a person fleeing the area after hearing gunshots. The witness was then flown in a police helicopter to a nearby interstate where Ralph was arrested, and the witness said he confirmed it was the person he had seen. Just 9 weeks earlier, Trump had survived an attempt on his life while campaigning in Butler, Pennsylvania. That gunman had fired 8 shots, with 1 bullet grazing Trump's ear. The gunman was then fatally shot by a Secret Service countersniper. Routh was a North Carolina construction worker who in recent years had moved to Hawaii. A self-styled mercenary leader, Routh spoke out to anyone who would listen about his dangerous and sometimes violent plans to insert himself into conflicts around the world, witnesses have told the Associated Press. In the early days of Russia's war in Ukraine, Routh tried to recruit soldiers from Afghanistan, Moldova, and Taiwan to fight the Russians. In his native Greensboro, North Carolina, he was arrested in 2002 for eluding a traffic stop and barricading himself from others with a fully automatic machine gun and a weapon of mass destruction, which turned out to be an explosive with a 10-inch fuse, police said. In 2010, police searched a warehouse Routh owned and found more than 100 stolen items, from power tools and building supplies to kayaks and spa tubs. In both felony cases, judges gave Routh either probation or a suspended sentence. Besides the federal charges, Routh also has pleaded not guilty to state charges of terrorism and attempted murder. Girl shot in the head in Minneapolis church attack is making miraculous progress, family says. A 12-year-old girl shot in the head during the deadly attack at a Catholic church in Minneapolis less than a month ago is making miraculous progress, her family said in a statement. Sophia Forchas, who was the most seriously wounded child among those who survived the shooting at the Church of the Annunciation, will move this week from acute care to an inpatient rehabilitation program, her family said. While her medical team remains cautiously optimistic, the family said Sophia shows signs of neurological recovery just weeks after doctors were unsure whether she would survive. Sophia is strong, brave, and unwavering in her fight toward healing. We ask that you continue to pray for her as she walks this road to recovery. It is by God's will that she has come this far, her family said in the statement released Monday by Hennepin Healthcare, where she is undergoing care. Sophia and her classmates at Annunciation Catholic School were celebrating the first Mass of the new school year when a shooter opened fire through a window, killing 2 students and wounding 21 people. The shooter died by suicide, police said. Sophia's mother, a nurse at Hennepin Healthcare, did not know she had been shot until after she arrived at work to help treat the shooting victims. Sophia underwent emergency surgery. Her neurosurgeon, Dr. Walt Galsich, said a bullet lodged in her brain, causing severe damage, including to a major blood vessel. Surgeons had to remove the left half of her skull to relieve the pressure inside her head. Though she still has a long journey ahead, filled with extensive therapy, her resilience continues to inspire hope at every step, her family said. 2 black men wrongly accused in 1989 killing a white woman in Boston get $150,000 from the city. 2 black men wrongly accused of killing a pregnant white woman in a high-profile case in Boston in 1989 have received a $150,000 settlement from the city 2 years after the mayor issued a formal apology. Alan Swanson and Willie Bennett were wrongly named as suspects in the death of Carol Stewart, whose husband said they had been shot during an attempted carjacking by a black gunman. Bennett will receive $100,000 from the settlement, and Swanson $50,000, city officials said. Charles Stewart had instead orchestrated the killing of his wife, Carol Stewart, as they left birthing class. She was shot in the head and died the next day while their baby, delivered by cesarean section, 17 days later. Charles Stewart, who was also white, was shot in the chest but survived. He died after jumping off a bridge a few months later as his story fell apart. In the interim, the case sparked a crackdown by police in a traditionally black neighborhood, heightening racial tensions in the city. Police first arrested Swanson before ruling him out, and then took Bennett into custody. Stewart later identified Bennett as the suspect, but neither man was ever formally charged in the case. Mayor Michelle Wu apologized in 2023 for both the pain the men endured and the harm it caused the black community. "What was done to you was unjust, unfair, racist, and wrong," she said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Iran's supreme leader rejects direct talks with U.S. over his country's nuclear program. Iran's supreme leader on Tuesday rejected direct negotiations with the United States over his country's nuclear program, likely slamming the door shut on a last-ditch effort to halt the reimposition of United Nations sanctions on Tehran. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's remarks aired on Iranian state television likely constrained any possible outreach to the U.S. by Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian, who is in New York for the UN General Assembly. Separately, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi held meetings there with diplomats from France, Germany, and Britain over the reimposition of the sanctions set to take effect Sunday. "Talks with the U.S. represent a sheer dead end," Khamenei said. "The U.S. has announced result of talks in advance," he added. "The result is the closure of nuclear activities and enrichment. This is not a negotiation. It is a diktat, an imposition." The German Foreign Office, in comments posted on X after the meeting with Araghchi, said that France, Germany, Britain, and the EU urged Iran to take steps within days, if not hours, to address concerns over its nuclear program. "It should resume direct talks with the U.S. and provide the International Atomic Energy Agency with access to all its nuclear sites, in line with its obligations," the statement said. The three European countries, known as the E3, triggered the so-called snapback mechanism to reinstate sanctions, barring a last-minute accord over Iran's failure to comply with conditions of a 2015 nuclear deal aimed at preventing Tehran from developing nuclear weapons. The meeting Tuesday did not appear to move closer to a resolution before Saturday's deadline, but a French diplomat said that the European leaders plan to make full use of the remaining time. The diplomat spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to publicly discuss the private meeting. The German Foreign Office said diplomatic engagement would continue even if sanctions are reimposed Sunday. Earlier, Germany's Foreign Minister Johann Wudffel had described the chance of reaching an agreement with Iran by the weekend extremely slim, the Germany news agency DPA had reported, even before Khamenei's comments. Iran has stopped inspectors, refused U.S. talks. Amid a flurry of diplomatic engagements, Araghchi on Monday also met with Rafael Grossi, the IAEA Director General in New York. Earlier this month, the UN nuclear watchdog and Iran signed an agreement mediated by Egypt to pave the way for resuming cooperation, including on ways of relaunching inspections of Iran's nuclear facilities. However, that agreement has yet to fully take hold. In July, Pezeshkian had signed a law adopted by his country's parliament suspending all cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog. That followed Israel's 12-day war with Iran in June, during which Israel and the U.S. bombed Iranian nuclear sites. France, Germany, and the U.K. began the process of reimposing sanctions on Iran at the end of August. The process, termed a snapback by the diplomats who negotiated it into Iran's 2015 nuclear deal with world powers was designed to be veto-proof at the UN, it started a 30-day clock ticking for the resumption of sanctions unless the West and Iran reach a diplomatic agreement. European nations have said they would be willing to extend the deadline if Iran resumes direct negotiations with the U.S. over its nuclear program, allows UN nuclear inspectors access to its nuclear sites, and accounts for the more than 880 pounds of highly enriched uranium the UN watchdog says it has. Iran is the only nation in the world that enriches uranium up to 60%, a short technical step from weapons-grade levels that does not have a weapons program. If no diplomatic deal is found this week, the sanctions will automatically snap back on Sunday. That would again freeze Iranian assets abroad, halt arms deals with Tehran, and penalize any development of Iran's ballistic missile program, among other measures, further squeezing the country's reeling economy. Khamenei made a point in his roughly half-hour speech to say his comments focused only on America, not on Europe. Iran maintains its atomic program is peaceful. Iran has long insisted its program is peaceful, though Western nations and the IAEA assessed that Tehran had an active nuclear weapons program until 2003. Khamenei again pledged that Iran does not seek atomic bombs. "We do not have a nuclear bomb, and we will not have one, and we do not plan to use nuclear weapon," he said. U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, made a point to reference Tehran in his speech before the UN on Tuesday. He recounted writing a letter to Khamenei seeking talks. U.S. and Iranian negotiators met five times before the 12-day war in June. "There is no more serious danger to our planet today than the most powerful and destructive weapons ever devised by man, of which the United States, as you know, has many," Trump said. "I've made containing these threats a top priority, starting with the nation of Iran." However, Khamenei stressed that Israeli and American attacks would not destroy the nuclear knowledge gained by Iran over the decades of the crisis surrounding the program. "Science will not be demolished by threats and bombing," he vowed. Nightmare bacteria cases are increasing in the U.S. Infection rates from drug-resistant nightmare bacteria rose almost 70% between 2019 and 2023, according to a new report from Centers for Disease Control and Prevention scientists. Bacteria that are difficult to treat due to the so-called NDM gene primarily drove the increase, CDC researchers wrote in an article published Monday in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Only two antibiotics work against those infections, and the drugs are expensive and must be administered through an IV, researchers said. Bacteria with the gene were once considered exotic, linked to a small number of patients who received medical care overseas. Though the numbers are still small, the rate of U.S. cases jumped more than fivefold in recent years, the researchers reported. "The rise of NDMs in the U.S. is a grave danger and very worrisome," said David Weiss, an Emory University infectious diseases researcher, in an email. "It's likely many people are unrecognized carriers of the drug-resistant bacteria, which could lead to community spread," the CDC scientists said. "That may play out in doctors' offices across the country, as infections long considered routine and easy to treat, like urinary tract infections, could become chronic problems," said Dr. Maroya Walters, one of the report's authors. "Antimicrobial resistance occurs when germs such as bacteria and fungi gain the power to fight off the drugs designed to kill them. The misuse of antibiotics was a big reason for the rise. Unfinished or unnecessary prescriptions that didn't kill the germs made them stronger." In recent years, the CDC has drawn attention to nightmare bacteria resistant to a wide range of antibiotics. That includes carbapenems, a class of antibiotics considered a last resort for treatment of serious infections. Researchers drew data from 29 states that do the necessary testing and reporting of carbapenem-resistant bacteria. They counted 4,341 cases of carbapenem-resistant bacterial infections from those states in 2023, with 1,831 of them the NDM variety. The researchers did not say how many of the infected people died. The rate of carbapenem-resistant infections rose from just under 2 per 100,000 people in 2019 to more than 3 per 100,000 in 2023, an increase of 69%, but the rate of NDM cases rose from around 0.25 to about 1.35, an increase of 460%, the authors said. A researcher not involved in the study said the increase is probably related to the COVID-19 pandemic. We know that there was a huge surge in antibiotic use during the pandemic, so this likely is reflected in increasing drug resistance, said Dr. Jason Burnham, a Washington University researcher, in an email. The CDC's count is only a partial picture. Many states are not fully testing and reporting cases. Even in states that do, cases tend to be among hospital patients sick enough to warrant special testing. Many hospitals also aren't able to do the testing needed to detect certain forms of genetic resistance. The CDC researchers did not have data from some of the most populous states, including California, Florida, New York, and Texas, which means the absolute number of U.S. infections is definitely underestimated, Burnham said. This is not the first study to report a rise. A CDC report published in June noted an increase in NDM cases in New York City between 2019 and 2024. Lax gun laws in Brazil and U.S. help arm Brazil's organized crime, study finds. Gunmen in a car opened fire last November at Sao Paulo's airport and killed a cryptocurrency entrepreneur in a daytime hit that was one of Brazil's most shocking recent crimes. Police at the scene recovered 3 semi-automatic rifles that are restricted for civilian use. The case highlighted a growing trend. Restricted use, military-style firearms, are increasingly ending up in the hands of Brazilian criminal organizations, according to a study published Tuesday by the São de Paz Institute, a Brazilian nonprofit that tracks gun violence. Most of the guns are made in Brazil, but in second place are those that come from the United States. The victim, Antonio Vinicius Lopes Gritzbach, had received death threats from a powerful international criminal group called First Command of the Capital, or PCC, after he agreed to a plea bargain to testify about his ties to the organization. Found at the scene were a Smith & Wesson semi-automatic rifle bought by a U.S. citizen 15 years before at a gun shop in Winchester, Virginia, and abandoned in a backpack near Sao Paulo's International Airport, according to police records reviewed by the Associated Press. The other two were Romanian-made weapons also purchased in the United States. Authorities have not determined how the guns entered Brazil. Researchers study cases of nearly 7,000 seized guns. The study by São de Paz Institute analyzed restricted firearm seizures from 2019 to 2023 in Brazil's southeast, the country's largest region and home to both Sao Paulo's PCC and a group based in Rio de Janeiro called Red Command. Researchers reviewed records of nearly 7,000 seized guns, combining data obtained through Freedom of Information requests with police records from the region's 4 states. The data included seizure dates, locations, crime types, and weapon details. It showed an 11.4% increase in the seizures of restricted military-style guns over the 5-year period. The study attributes at least part of the rise in heavy weaponry in criminal hands to looser gun regulations in Brazil under former President Jair Bolsonaro, who authorized many kinds of weapons once restricted to military and police use for civilians, including 9mm pistols and some semi-automatic rifles. The number of privately owned firearms nearly doubled from 1.3 million at the end of 2018 to 2.9 million in 2022, according to the study. Some of these guns were diverted to the illegal market after an increase of reported stolen guns from sport shooters and collectors. It's clear that weaker gun controls during the Bolsonaro administration opened a new pathway for organized crime, cheaper with a veneer of legality and enabled by straw buyers of rifles, said Carolina Ricardo, executive director of Saúde da Paz. In July 2023, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva signed a decree tightening restrictions on civilian access to guns, reversing the pro-firearms policies of his right-wing predecessor. The decree restored restrictions on semi-automatic weapons, reduced the number of guns civilians can possess for personal safety from 4 to 2, and required documentation proving the need to hold the weapons. Lula also tightened weapon registration requirements. The United States is a key supplier. While the majority of seized firearms were Brazil-made, U.S. origin weapons rank second. The U.S. was the main foreign source of both complete firearms and unmarked components feeding Brazil's illegal market, the study showed. Natalia Palacci, one of the authors of the study, said that there is a well-documented smuggling route from the U.S. to Brazil through Paraguay, Peru, and Bolivia. The study found that not only complete firearms, but also separate components for restricted use weapons from the U.S. are illegally entering Brazil and being assembled locally. The United States plays a key role because parts and components are sold there with far less regulation. Police reports often show these items being smuggled into Brazil, Palacci said, added. Ricardo of Saúde da Paz said that if the U.S. government believes the growth of organized crime threatens its interests, as it has with Mexico and Canada, it must also recognize that weak gun controls in the U.S. directly fuel organized crime in Brazil. It's fair for the U.S. to demand action from Brazil, the executive director of Saúde da Paz said, but it must first admit it is part of the problem. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier radio reading service. A ship comes under attack off the coast of Yemen as Houthi rebels continue to threaten vessels. A ship traveling off the coast of Yemen in the Gulf of Aden came under attack early on Tuesday, officials said, though no one was hurt. It was not clear who launched the attack. The captain of the vessel heard a splash and explosion in the vicinity of the vessel, the British military's United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center said in a statement. Vessel and crew reported safe and proceeding to next port of call, the center said in a statement. The attack happened about 140 miles off the coast of Aden, which is held by forces loyal to Yemen's exiled government. Yemen's Iranian-backed Houthi rebels have launched a series of attacks targeting shipping through the Red Sea corridor, but did not immediately claim the attack. It typically takes them hours or even days to claim an assault. The Houthi rebels have been launching missile and drone attacks on Israel and on ships in the Red Sea in response to the war in Gaza, saying they were acting in solidarity with Palestinians. Their attacks over the past 2 years have upended shipping in the Red Sea, through which about $1 trillion of goods passed each year before the war. The Houthis stopped their attacks during a brief ceasefire in the war. They later became the target of an intense weeks-long campaign of airstrikes ordered by U.S. President Donald Trump before he declared a ceasefire had been reached with the rebels. The Hooghly sank two vessels in July, killing at least four on board, with others believed to be held by the rebels. The attack on Tuesday came as Israel has intensified its war, targeting Gaza City with a new ground offensive. Meanwhile, tensions remain high as United Nations sanctions are due to be reimposed on Iran over Tehran's battered nuclear program. Israel launched a 12-day war against the Islamic Republic, in which the Americans bombed three Iranian atomic sites. As Western nations recognize Palestinian statehood, Palestinians doubt its impact. Palestinians across the Gaza Strip and the Israeli-occupied West Bank welcomed news that a flurry of Western countries have recognized a Palestinian state, while expressing doubt the move will improve their dire circumstances. On Monday, France, Andorra, Belgium, Luxembourg, Malta, and Monaco announced or confirmed their recognition of a Palestinian state at the start of a whole high-profile meeting at the United Nations aimed at galvanizing support for a two-state solution to the Mideast conflict. Their announcements came a day after the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and Portugal did the same. More nations are expected to follow in defiance of Israel and the United States. The recognitions have strengthened the Palestinian legitimacy by recognizing the rights of the Palestinian people, said Saeed Abu Alaish, a medic from the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, who has lost more than two dozen family members, including his wife and their two daughters. It's also a call to stop the genocide and massacres in Gaza, as well as to stop the settlers' encroachment on the West Bank, he told the Associated Press. Others downplayed the impact of the recognitions. Huda Maslami called them worthless as she joined a long line of fellow displaced people and overstuffed trucks heading south from Gaza City Sunday. We just hope to God that someone outside would acknowledge us or even deal with us as mere human beings, she said. The recent shift among nations is unlikely to have much, if any, short-term impact on the ground, where Israel is waging a major offensive in famine-stricken Gaza City and expanding settlements in the West Bank. Longer term, the creation of a Palestinian state alongside Israel in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem territories seized by Israel in the 1967 Mideast War is widely seen internationally as the only way to resolve the conflict, which began more than a century before Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack. In Gaza, Palestinians hope statehood recognition is followed by action. Israel's government was opposed to Palestinian statehood even before the outbreak of the war in Gaza, and now says it would reward Hamas. Israelis have long feared that groups like Hamas, which does not accept Israel's existence, would use an independent state to attack it. Many also view the West Bank as the biblical and historical heartland of the Jewish people. While Palestinians in Gaza told the AP that they hoped statehood recognition might lead to eventual independence, it comes as cold comfort in the midst of Israel's devastating 23-month war. What matters to us is that the war stops, Adib Abu Khalid, a displaced Palestinian from Gaza City, said as he walked in a Deir al-Bala market Tuesday. Today we are living in famine. People are in misery. The war has left the territory in ruins, displaced nearly all Palestinians, and killed at least 65,000 people, according to Gaza's health ministry. The ministry is part of the Hamas-run government and staffed by medical professionals. It doesn't say how many were civilians or combatants, but says women and children make up around half. In that context, demonstrations of support from abroad do provide a measure of solace to some, like Nasser Asaliya, a displaced Palestinian from Gaza City, who are eager for any ray of hope. It will, God willing, have a positive impact on us, no matter the circumstances, he said. We are a stricken people, and we hope for anything that makes us happy, no matter how simple, anything that supports us, strengthens our resolve in light of this unjust blockade. Around 3/4 of the 193-member United Nations now recognize a Palestinian state, but major Western nations had until recently declined to, saying one could only come about through negotiations with Israel. Murad Banat, a Palestinian man displaced from Gaza's central Barash camp, said the most recent recognitions are just talk. Everyone is watching us like a play, like a TV series, every day a TV series, he said, as children strode between tents in a packed displacement camp. West Bank Palestinians see statehood recognition as conflicting with reality. Since the war began, Israeli settlers have expanded their hold over vast swaths of Israeli-occupied West Bank, pushing the prospect of a contiguous Palestinian state out of reach. The West Bank is the hoped-for heartland of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians say now common Israeli military raids on Palestinian cities and towns ramped up settler violence, and state-backed settlement expansion has eaten away at their land, pushing the practical possibility of a contiguous Palestinian state from reach. Nur al-Din Mansour from Jenin is one of tens of thousands of West Bank Palestinians displaced from their homes since Israel launched a major operation across 4 northern camps early this year. He said recognition was a step in the right direction. But what we want, he added, is not just a symbolic or nominal state. We want a fully sovereign state that preserves its borders. We demand a Palestinian state based on the borders of June 5, 1967. Mohammed Hamad, also displaced from Jenin camp, said, "All this recognition, in the end, is meaningless. You're talking nonsense about recognition while we're still under occupation. In the end, everything that happens is just ink on paper." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 23rd issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Brian. Thank you for listening.